Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. The Dakota Political Junkies are a panel of reporters and editors doing the most insightful political coverage in the state. We sit down with two of them every Wednesday. Today, we are fortunate to spend some time with John Hunter and Denise Ross. Denise Ross is an editor with Black Hills Knowledge Network and South Dakota Dashboard. She joins us today from Rapid City. Denise, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
It's great to be here, Lori.
And John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, thanks for being here as well.
Hi, Lori. Thank you.
We're going to start with EB5 because, for obvious reasons, maybe, because it's the big story to start with and because it's confusing me. So, Denise, let's start with you and maybe go back a ways and tell us what the program is and why it's such a big story still.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of moving parts, so I'll try to keep this as simple as I can. Anybody who's really interested can go online and really get an education, but be prepared to spend quite a bit of time reading. But what EB-5 is a federal program that allows wealthy foreigners to essentially buy their way into the United States as immigrants. They get to cut to the front of the line if they invest. The dollar amounts vary somewhat, but it's typically $500,000 in a quote-unquote approved business in the United States. So the trade-off is they help to provide some capital to promote economic development in the United States. They get to cut to the front of the line, and not just them, but their entire family gets to cut to the front of the line and come to the United States and live. And so it's administered through what they call regional centers. And in South Dakota, there was one regional center designated by the state. The regional center is the place that approves the businesses, goes out and kind of is a matchmaker between businesses that are looking for capital and the wealthy foreigners who are looking to come to the United States. I don't know how it works in other regional centers, but in South Dakota, it was predominantly Chinese investors who were coming in. And there were numerous projects that were funded. It started out being a state-owned and operated regional center out of Northern State University in Aberdeen. The state employee who was responsible for running the program was named Joop Bolin, and you'll see his name spelled J-O-O-P, but it's pronounced Joop. He's from the Netherlands. He's an immigrant himself. Then, after a couple of years of doing this and seeing how other regional centers were being operated privately, things got really weird, and he signed a contract with himself to turn the program over to this private company that he had created with some partners who have mostly been unnamed. And then they started charging a lot of fees to these investors on top of the $500,000 they were investing. They were charging like just a surcharge of $10,000 a year as an administration fee and all kinds of other fees tacked on. And the private regional center started raking in millions. If I remember right, the total amount that's been calculated to the best of everyone's what they can determine with what's public is about $120 million came in. What happened last week, well, the state has shut the program down because there were a lot of issues happening after the death of a former state cabinet member, which I can't, I just go into, would take over an hour. But all happened back in like 2013, 2014.
Okay.
And right at the time that Governor Mike Rounds was running for election, Governor Mike Rounds took to the U.S. Senate, was a huge champion of EB-5. Mm-hmm. So last week, Joop Bolin, the guy who signed the state employee, former state employee, who signed a contract with himself to create this private regional center, got charged with some felonies. The felonies that he got charged with were, the best analogy that I've been able to come up with is, if you're a renter and you have to put a deposit down to cover mm-hmm. any damages, right? He went in because when he signed the contract with the state and then the state discovered it, they went in and amended the contract and forced him to set some money aside to protect them in the case of any lawsuits, which there were lawsuits. He went in and raided those funds, the deposit funds, quote unquote, and use them to buy Egyptian antiquities, to invest in some TIF bonds in Aberdeen on one of the EB-5 projects that was being funded up there, and to do a couple other things. So all told, he took about $1 million. He put a lot of it back, not all of it, but It's not embezzlement or theft. It's called, I think, misappropriation of a security or something. It's a state statute that I think we're all going to get very familiar with. But that's what happened last week. So, I mean, just one more thing, not to go on and on, but like I said, this is complicated. The extraordinary political piece of this is, you know, first everybody thought this had kind of gone away and faded away because Marty Jackley, who's the state attorney general, had initially said they looked into it and they didn't find anything to charge. That was a couple years ago. There had been, on the record, the FBI said they weren't conducting an investigation, but that just hasn't produced anything. Nobody's heard a peep out of that. So people who were keeping an eye on this thought, well, it just kind of faded into the background. Now all of a sudden there's so many charges coming from Marty Jackley. And the extraordinary thing is Marty Jackley said in a press conference last week that he wanted to bring integrity back to state government, which was a stunning... I don't know how many editorials may have been written yet, but online the discussion has just gone almost more about Marty Jackley and that statement than what's going on with Yul Bolin and what the charges are and what he might be facing in court, because it's an admission that there are problems with corruption and integrity in state government, which has long been a partisan issue. Well, Marty's a mainline mainstream Republican who everybody expects to run for governor. So I think we're going to see, I think we're starting to see Marty Jackley's platform for his governor's campaign, which is going to be an extraordinary thing to watch. And the other piece of this is Yul Bolin's defense attorney said Yul Bolin was being made a scapegoat for the EB-5 problems, which is being interpreted by the people who watch this sort of thing as admitting that there are people involved who committed wrongdoing and that so far Yul Bolin is the only one who's been charged. So with that, there's a lot more to it, but with that, I'll just be quiet and let you move on to what you want to move on to.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that overview. That's helpful to have it all in one spot like that. John, do you want to chip in on any missing pieces of that are particularly significant that you wanted to add?
Sure. I thought Denise did a great job of summarizing a 10-hour lecture into 5 minutes. So I appreciate that, and she's got it square. There are a couple things that I think are interesting about this. One is that this really, the EB-5 program, a federal program, was started with good intentions, and part of the thing too is to encourage foreign investment in the United States. That was part of the deal, and part of that too then is saying, if we're going to have immigrants come to the United States legally, would you rather have those who are can bring a lot of economic value to those, or those who would require a lot of support from the government? And the idea was, let's bring investors over and sound business persons to fund economic development projects in especially poorer areas in the United States. But the whole point of that is that it was good intentions gone wrong. And as many of these programs are, and I think it's throughout many levels of government, is that you find ways to manipulate that system or those good intentions and turn them into something else. And again, the whole idea of buying visas was not the intention of this thing. Is to say, you pay $500,000, you get a visa. That's not the whole thing. It was intended to be an investment, and yes, you can move here and so forth. And then it gets farther twisted. Again, this privatization of the regional center that Denise was talking about, and then it's kind of the one step further where you start adding fees and you're doing all this stuff. Now, Yul Bolin is as Denise described, is a business person. He's been involved in businesses. He's an immigrant from the Netherlands and has always been known as kind of an aggressive, kind of high-risk-taking business person. And so none of that conflicts with what was going on here. It does probably conflict a little bit with what state government agency employees are expected to do. They typically aren't big risk takers in kind of high win, high lose kind of situations. So I wanted to emphasize, I think the program originally had good intentions. It has worked out certainly much better in other states than in this one, but this one has kind of fallen apart and suspended, of course.
So, John, does
both by the state and by the feds.
John, was it the privatization that kind of made it fall apart? Was just the criminal intent of Yul Bolin?
That's a very good question. It's part of what Attorney General Jackley is doing, but I think they both contributed. I think there was probably criminal intent early in the process. The privatization was maybe helped facilitate that, too. Of course, and we talked about Richard Benda being having mm-hmm. charges prepared against him when he took his life, and as a partner of Yop Bolin. So far, and as Denise mentioned, these investigations, both the FBI and state, seemed to be stalled. Mm. Excuse me, stalled for a long time. But I want to hit one other point that relates to this, and that is the defense of kind of political persecution. And as you know, Bolin's attorney said, being made a scapegoat. And that, remember, is becoming kind of a more popular defense lately. That's, remember, in our Senate race, where they say, well, this is political persecution is why Attorney General Jackley is charging me for Bosworth. So that's kind of trying to turn the tables and saying, no, the prosecutor's the bad guy. I'm not the bad guy. I'm the victim mm-hmm. here. And so, but it's becoming a more popular defense. The good news, in my opinion, still is that the courts still rely basically on fact. They're not going to say all these allegations around this. They're going to say, here's the law, did you break the law, and then you're guilty or innocent of that thing. So I would expect we won't hear a lot more about, I mean, we may hear more about political persecution, but when it gets to the court itself, it should be based on facts.
So is there any potential political impact on Senator Mike Rounds, who was governor at the time, or is he pretty much, because it happened after his tenure and after things had been privatized, is this not really point anything at him? Denise, you want to tackle that?
Well, I think that's a big question. People are certainly watching for that. I personally would be really surprised if there were any criminal charges brought against him, for example. But I do think this has just dogged him through his Senate campaign in 2014. It's still things that get brought up about this. There was a vote in Congress after he got elected to renew the program. He voted in favor of that. And I just think, you can bet when he runs for re-election that this is all going to come back again. Whoever runs against him is going to use this against him. So I think this is built into his political biography, if nothing else. And we'll just have to stand by and see if it gets any more serious than that.
John, what's your take on this idea of bringing integrity back to state government?
Well, it's fascinating, and I think it's a real turn for South Dakota in this thing. I think in some cases one scandal could have been dismissed by South Dakotans, and then you combine this with the Gear Up thing and Platt and some other kind of less known kinds of things, and I think all of a sudden South Dakotans are more aware of this and believe it. And so I think it will be an issue in the next gubernatorial election. I think it could very well be an issue in a lot of legislative elections. You know, South Dakota, again, being a small state and people knowing each other so much, I think we have placed a lot of faith in that, and in some cases that faith has been abused. And so that's going to affect us all. I think there will be, and there should be a lot more scrutiny of these kinds of things. Frankly, I think, Mike Rounds just said recently, you know, the feds should have been watching this EB-5 thing more closely. Well, yeah, but that doesn't absolve the state from its own responsibility of doing it. And frankly, I think there's not only executive branch authority there, the Department of Legislative Audit should be a part of that. I mean, there should be all sorts of checks and balances for huge amounts of money coming into a state agency and then essentially a state-sponsored private organization, and this should extend well to bids and to contracts and all those kinds of things. So, yes, I think that has launched a new campaign topic that may very well be the top campaign topic of the next gubernatorial election.
If we become sort of mentally primed as a citizenry to look for scandal, do we risk, is that a healthy thing? Are we developing a healthy skepticism as voters? Or do we risk a cynicism that doesn't sort of match up with our nature? Denise?
Well, I think that it's healthy to be skeptical, but unhealthy to be cynical. And I do think it's only natural when you see what's happened with EB-5, with Gear Up. You have dead people, dead children in the case of Gear Up, And a whole lot, I can just tell you, a whole lot of questions still swirling around all of that, and a lot of skepticism swirling around the official explanation of what has happened, and a lot of skepticism still about the death of Richard Benda, and whether or not that really was a suicide, that continues to linger. And so I think that's driven by the facts on the ground. When you've got dead bodies, people are going to take notice of that, especially in a state this small where people know everybody. Excuse me. And so, you know, I think it's going to depend on how the officials respond, how they react, and whether people really feel like they've gotten to the bottom of what really happened. And I don't think we're there yet. Maybe this, these felony charges are the beginning of that. We'll just have to wait and see. But I don't think you can blame the voters. I think it really depends on officialdom and how serious they take this themselves and how serious they take corruption, which now we've got Marty Jackley, the Attorney General, saying there's a loss of integrity at the state and in state government. So I think, you know, I think we need to put the blame where it really lies. I think in a democracy, the voters should be paying attention to this kind of thing and asking a lot of hard questions.
So let's switch topics a little bit and talk about the presidential primaries. Wisconsin was last night. A couple of interesting developments there. John, do you want to talk a little bit about the South Dakota primary and how that works and why all of a sudden, the closer we get, it starts to look like it might be important?
Thanks. I'd love to. Do you have any other guests today that we need to? This could take a while, but I'll be as brief as I can. The primary system in the United States and in each state is a kind of an odd mix, really, of party politics and federal and state law, and so they all kind of tie together. And interestingly, I think that's different for both parties, and it's different by state. So in some senses, you have 100 different sets of political primaries, 50 states for each party. And in most cases, especially in South Dakota, state law sets up a process for this. And it does turn over a lot of authority for the nomination process to the party. And so as long as the party kind of files how they're going to set their delegates, then they can go ahead and do that. Two recognized parties are allowed to do that in South Dakota, set up presidential political primaries, the Republicans and Democrats, and they have both set up processes for that. At the heart of it, Lori, really is the fact that we don't elect candidates directly by our votes in each state. We instead elect delegates who go to a national convention who then vote. And so the process, by and large, and again, all these different rules set up, but by and large it said that there are certain delegates that are going to be bound to vote for a particular candidate based on what the primary voters have stated when they hit the ballot box or the caucus, and then on the first ballot. And then once, if there's no clear majority, an absolute majority, then they said then these delegates are free to vote their own conscience. And so really it gets back really one step, two, you might even go two steps back where you elect delegates, and so those people are the ones you're essentially putting your faith in that they will, if it does go to a second ballot, who are they going to support? And so in South Dakota, it starts at the county level. So you nominate delegates from the county, and then they go elect delegates at the state convention, and then it goes to them. You can see, but this is all, it's all sanctioned by the federal government and by the states, so it's not a process that's being usurped. I think, you know, when we talk about the Republicans and going to a contested convention, I think that's a negative word that doesn't need to be. This is, no one's breaking any rules here or doing anything. Maybe it's not what we're used to because for so many years we've always had a clear majority of delegates who are required to vote for a particular candidate, and the convention's become a big political public relations kind of thing. But we've had many conventions in our history where it goes, and these delegates decide who the nominee is going to be, and that looks as though it may happen this year in the Republican side. So South Dakota delegates, our friends and neighbors, are going to go to Cleveland in this summer, and could very well those people are going to be who determines who one of the two nominees is.
So we're going to have a lot to talk about until then and beyond, aren't we, John?
Yes, I hope I didn't take too long in that explanation.
You know what? That's a perfect overview and also a reminder that we probably do need to move on. So we're going to come back to that conversation next week. So John Hunter, publisher of Madison Daily Leader, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Lori.
And Denise Ross, editor with Black Hills Knowledge Network and South Dakota Dashboard. Denise, thanks as well.
Thank you.